From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. Sekou Sundiata is one of the fathers of the spoken word movement. On today's Fresh Air, he performs an excerpt from his theater piece, Blessing the Boats, about the year he almost died, suffering through kidney failure and a bad car accident. Blessing the Boats is about no longer being the self you thought yourself to be. It's now on stage at the Apollo Theater in Manhattan. Also, we talk with writer Marilyn Robinson. Her novel, Gilead, just won the National Book Critics Circle Award and is a Penn Faulkner Award finalist. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Old Boy, a South Korean film that won the Grand Jury Prize at last year's Cannes Film Festival. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Sekou Sundiata, is a poet, performer, and one of the fathers of the spoken word movement. Greg Tate wrote in The Village Voice, "Sundiata is to contemporary African-American poetry what Marvin Gaye was to modern soul." Sundiata has a one-man show about the period when he had kidney failure, dialysis, and a kidney transplant. Toward the end of 1999, after his transplant, he was on the way to his comeback performance driving through the snow in New England when his car slid off the road and he broke his neck. He spent the following year recovering from surgery. Fortunately, he has no paralysis or disability. He says his show is a personal look at the world from a forced withdrawal, an exile from the self he had come to know. His show is called Blessing the Boats, and he's been performing it off and on for 3 years. His health is good now, and he's currently performing Blessing the Boats at the Apollo Theater in New York through April 10th. The title of his show is taken from a poem by Lucille Clifton, who also had a kidney transplant. Terry talked with Sekou Sundiata in 2002. He began with an excerpt from Blessing the Boats.
This is from a section called The Part That Hurts. Here I am, a middle-aged brother with the shakes who can't stay awake, who has to hold on to the wall because his head is spinning like a gyroscope. A poet who can't make poems because there's too much distance between his mind and his body. And anyway, his mind is so slow and confused that ideas just bounce around and reverberate like a sound effect. Where's my witty? Where's my sovereignty? And most of all, where the hell is my cool? I was no longer the self I thought myself to be. How do you just wake up one day and not be who you think you are? I'll tell you how. The body is a low-down, dirty sneak. It remembers every physical or psychological insult it ever suffered. And each insult leaves a scar. And that scar is a map to the insult that just lays in the cut like a memorial. And should you delete it from your memory, your body will retrieve the data and bring it back up just when you're trying to go to sleep. Or just when somebody tells you that you're cute. Or just when you tell yourself how cool you are. Here comes the big payback. Your body will break you down. It will make you beg. It will make you change your priorities. For example, I was surprised to find out the size of the kidney. The kidney's job is to regulate a delicate balance of chemicals and minerals and water in the body. They clean the blood and regulate blood pressure. Big job, big organs. Simple as that. But most kidneys are the size of a small fist, and they're located in the back, off to the side. I had taken it for granted that the most important part of the body was located front and center. This is what I mean about the body being a sneak. It'll let you believe things like that until it's ready to tell you the truth. It ain't the heart, or the lungs, or the brain. The biggest, most important part of the body is the part that hurts.
Sekou Sundiata, I really like this piece a lot. Why did you want to do a performance about your period of medical crisis?
Well, you know, first of all, this, in writing this piece, it is written in a way that is very different from the way I write. I don't write in a really personal way or an obviously autobiographical way. The first thing that drove me to write about this was my experience of going on dialysis and needing a transplant. I was on the transplant waiting list, which, you know, can be anywhere from 2 years to 5 years or more for some people. And during that period of time, five of my friends came forward and volunteered to be donors, to donate a kidney. And, you know, we went through the whole process of tissue typing and blood testing and all of that. And four out of the five people were found to be a match. It's very unusual, very rare, especially for people who are not related. And, you know, I was moved by that personally. And, you know, to me, it was a story that it just had so many implications to it in terms of what I call grace. The idea that for me, I couldn't have done anything to really earn anybody's kidney. Yet here were these people coming forward, volunteering to put their lives in jeopardy to save mine, essentially. So I was really driven by that this to me was just some unearned grace that is always compelling story.
This is a very different kind of story for you in several ways. As you say, your things aren't often personal in that sense. And also, a lot of your stories are about somebody who's very mythic in a way, very cool or very revolutionary or very much about romantic love or risk-taking. Or you know, you're writing sometimes about being African American in America, mm-hmm. and what that means. And this is about being vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah, no question. Experience of having what's called end-stage renal disease and not knowing for quite some time, I'm talking about 3 years or more, 3-4 years, really what was wrong, you know, thinking that the symptoms sometimes can be some of anything. You know, there's a cluster of symptoms that can relate to a number of different things, and they're easy to excuse, especially if you're living a very busy and active life, which is what I was doing at the time. You know, I felt by the time I was diagnosed with having renal failure, it was a new way of thinking about myself and a new way of thinking about my body. You know, I grew up being very active, being a amateur athlete, running, playing sports and all of those things. And all of a sudden, my body would not do what I wanted it to do, you know, when I wanted it to do it. So it was a whole new way of being vulnerable.
How did you know something was wrong?
That's a good question. Well, you know, the things I felt was fatigue, tiredness, I was yawning all the time, frequent urination, those kinds of things. And frankly, you know, at the time, I was very busy. I was touring with a show around the country, and I thought these things were due to being just tired and worn out, to traveling so much. You know, at one point in the piece, I talk about, you know, being in cheap hotels, lousy venues, breathing recycled airplane air, all of these things, you know, that we generally talk about when, I guess, when we get a general, being generally run down, which is how I felt. But what I noticed is that other people would feel the same way. So, I would say, well, you know, everybody I know is tired and run down. But they would recover, you know, they would rest for a week, 2 days, whatever, and recover. I could never recover. So it was almost as if there was this long-running flu that was trapped in my system. That was the first clue. The event that triggered it is I was having breakfast with a couple of friends in a restaurant one morning, and they told me that my face had broken out. I had these tiny bumps all over my face. We finished breakfast, and I went straight to the doctor, and, you know, the doctor examined me, and I did it, gave him a urine test. And he called me the next day to say that there was something in the test that indicated my kidney function wasn't right. So I went to see a kidney specialist, a nephrologist. That's when I found out that at that point, my kidneys were at 50%.
What was your initial way of dealing with being sick? Did you push yourself? Did you become more self-protective?
No, not really. My kidney disease, we suspect, was brought about by hypertension, probably long-term undiagnosed high blood pressure. And when I got that diagnosis from the urine test and I saw the nephrologist, basically I began blood pressure, hypertension medication. And so I was really trying to really stay with that. And then I started exercising and eating better and doing those kinds of things. But after about 6 months, I really, like many people, I had an aversion to the idea of having to take a pill every day. So I started slacking off. I'd take the medicine every now and then, and et cetera, et cetera. So I still wasn't convinced that that this was really as serious as it was. Even though the doctor said my kidneys were at 50%, there was the belief that any further deterioration could be halted once the blood pressure was brought under control, and that, you know, I could live a life at 50% kidney function.
So did people start reacting to you differently once you became weaker?
I didn't really notice a difference then. I noticed a difference actually after the transplant. People pretty much reacted the same to me even when I was on dialysis. I think that had to do with the form of dialysis that I was on, which is called peritoneal dialysis, meaning I didn't have to go to a hemodialysis center every week. It's something I did myself. So I maintained a lot of my strength, and I looked, actually, I had more vitality, even in the way I look, than before I went on dialysis. Some of my health returned. So there wasn't much of a reaction there, but once I had the transplant, I guess people are very suspicious about organ transplantation and disease and all of those things. So, you know, I think people seeing me after the transplant, it kind of triggered something about their own mortality.
Sure.
You know? So I recognize that some people backed away. You uh-huh. know, some people kind of lost contact. And it's a sense, it's very difficult to put my finger on it because nobody ever says this outright. But for some people, not all by any means, but for some people, there was a sense that they had given up on me in some way.
Sekou Sundiata, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2002 interview with poet and performer Sekou Sundiata.
There are two ways of getting a new kidney if you have kidney disease. One is to get a kidney from somebody who has just died, who was an organ donor. And the other is to get the kidney from somebody who you know, who is willing to undergo surgery and donate one of their kidneys to you. You took that second route. Did you think you were initially going to go the other route of getting it from an anonymous organ donor?
Yeah, I was on the transplant list, and I was on the list for about a year and a half, and I had no intention of asking anyone for a kidney. That was another part of it. I just couldn't imagine asking someone to give me a kidney. In fact, the nurses who looked after me when I was on peritoneal dialysis told me that I was the first patient they had who never asked them for a kidney. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that somebody would just ask, especially essentially a stranger, for a kidney. So in my mind, it was settled that I would be on the list until I got that call saying that, you know, we have a kidney for you, come to the hospital. But a couple of my friends said just at first casually that, yeah, I would give you a kidney. And, you know, I kind of just said thank you at first, but yeah, it was. They mentioned it more than one time and wanted to talk about it seriously and wanted to know what it would take. And then finally it sank in, and, you know, I realized that, you know, these people were serious and they would really go through with the testing, and if they were a match, would donate, you know, donate their kidney. And, you know, again, these are unrelated. These are friends. These are not blood relatives.
So who are the people who made the offer?
Well, one is the woman that I love, I call Kazi, and she appears in the piece. The others are friends, you know, just two people were friends of hers who became friends of mine, you know, the longer we knew each other. One person is a long-term friend that I've known. Her name is Sydney. I've known her for about 20, 25 years. The other two people were two men named Bill and Claude. And then my close friend and manager, Katia Stitt, turned out to be the one who was the match, and turned out to be my. Actually, they were all matches, but she turned out to be the donor.
Why her? Why not the other people?
Well, since four out of five people matched, we had discussions about it. Basically, over dinner, we would go out and have these great.
For all of you, the whole group?
Yeah, we would call them transplant dinners. We have these great dinners with great food and, you know, wine and laughter and everything, and we would talk about the transplant. And finally, we all went to get tested together. And when the results came in, we had another meeting to talk about what to do since, you know, all these people matched. And basically, they ranked themselves. They decided that Kazi, who was the only one with a child, would be fourth, because she had a child, and there was some concern about that. Claude, who had some medical issues of his own going on, was ranked third. And then Bill, who was in good health and older than the rest, came in second. And Katia, who was in good health, the youngest, volunteered to be first. And then everyone else volunteered to be backup donors in case anything went wrong for any of us. You know, and to me, that was just remarkable. And whenever I would tell people the story, even before the transplant and after the transplant, whoever I tell that story to was really just moved by it. And so I thought that, you know, there's something in this story that is just beyond me. It's great, much, much greater than me. And it does speak to ideas about love and friendship, but also just about unearned grace.
It must seem like a real impossibility of repaying such a debt. You know, what can you do that measures up to somebody giving you their kidney?
I don't think you can do anything. You know, I really don't. I asked each of them, and especially Katia, since she ended up being a donor, you know, what can I do? You know, what could I possibly do? And, you know, being the people they are, everyone said, well, you know, just get healthy, get well, et cetera, et cetera. Those kinds of things. In my own mind, I thought that, you know, as a writer and a storyteller, I thought maybe what I could do is tell this story. You know, I've talked about this before. I come out of a tradition of testifying and witnessing, whether that was in the church or, you know, in literature or whatever. And that the idea that in these testimonies that there is great value in these stories. And sometimes you can't really see what the value is, you know, at the time that you're doing it or telling it, but you sense that there's some great value in the story. So if anything, I mean, I don't think of it as repaying a debt because I don't think that can be done, you know, but it is what I have to offer. I've been given this story, and I think that it may be useful.
You were preparing for a comeback concert in New England, and you were driving to this concert, you know, after you had gotten healthy enough following your kidney transplant to start performing again. You're driving in a snowstorm through New England to get to this comeback concert, and you were in a car accident and broke your neck in the car accident. And from my understanding, you nearly died in that accident. You were trapped in the car for a couple of hours. What was going through your mind when you were in that car with a broken neck after having just gotten through this horrible period of kidney failure, kidney transplant, post-kidney transplant surgeries, finally recover, and then you're in this horrible accident?
Well, my first thought, I mean, even as the car was sliding, you know, in the snow, was how absurd this was. You know, it just seemed stupid to me. I first of all, this happened in January of 2000. I had my last surgery related to the transplant in December. I don't even know if it was a full month before the accident. So I was still in a sense recuperating from that. So I thought that was, you know, I was putting that behind me when this whole thing happened. And I remember thinking as the car was sliding off the highway that I just couldn't believe it could all come down to this. You know, it just seemed like such an absurd and silly thing, you know, to happen. And then also, I have to tell you this, you know, I think that there's no question that my life was in danger. I didn't know that my neck was broken while I was there, you know, upside down in the snow. And I didn't think anybody could see that I'd gone off the road. But I never felt that I was going to die. You know, I never felt that was it. And I don't know, there's no physical evidence to support that idea because it was a blinding snowstorm. I dropped down a slope. You could not see me from the highway. And I couldn't even hear the car, the traffic on the highway passing by. So I had no real evidence to support that. It was just a blind faith that I had that somehow this was not it. At the same time, I'd never been so alone and isolated in my life. And I don't think I never knew things could be that quiet either. And then this woman shows up, kneeling beside the car in the storm, and she has a cell phone. And she starts talking to me, and she calls 911, and, you know, she gets all of that going. And by the time the fire department arrives, this woman is gone. I never see her again. I don't know her name or any of that, but she's just gone. And from at that point on, you know, the fire department has it, and they cut me out and all of that.
Did you have any idea before all this happened to you that people could be so good, so decent?
Yeah, I did. I did. You know, and really, it's a case of knowing something for quite some time, and then something happens, and you get to know it at an even deeper and more profound level. I've been fortunate in my life to just been helped and assisted by so many people, both people I've seen and then people I haven't seen, but I know that, you know, people have helped me in various ways. And, you know, I've had just an example of many, many examples of this kind of goodness. Having said that, it didn't diminish in any way the fact that this was seemingly out of the blue, you know, and very mysterious. I mean, she showed up and then she was gone, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that that's fundamental in the human heart, you know. And I think it's probably more common than we may perceive on a day-to-day basis.
It's really lucky and amazing that after breaking your neck, you didn't end up paralyzed or partially paralyzed. You got your full movement back, right?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. I started while I was trapped in the car. First thing I did was wiggle my toes and, you know, try and wiggle my fingers to see if I had function. Yeah, I was very, very fortunate.
Sekou Sundiata speaking to Terry Gross in 2002. He is performing Blessing the Boats, his show about his kidney failure and its aftermath, at New York's Apollo Theater through April 10th. Coming up, author Marilyn Robinson. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, featuring the 2005 ESPN Baseball Encyclopedia from Sterling Publishing, a division of Barnes & Noble. From Bantam, publisher of The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud, a novel about the enduring power of love by Ben Sherwood, author of The Man Who Ate the 747. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, award-winning fiction writer Marilyn Robinson talks about her book, Gilead. It's told in the form of a letter from a Congregationalist preacher in his 70s to his 7-year-old son. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the South Korean film, Old Boy. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Marilyn Robinson's new novel, Gilead, is a meditation on religion, family, war, and finding meaning in life. Reviewing it in the Washington Post, Michael Derda wrote that the novel is so serenely beautiful and written in prose so gravely measured and thoughtful that one feels touched with grace just to read it. Robinson just won the National Critics Circle Award for Gilead, and she was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. This is her first novel since the publication of her 1981 book, Housekeeping. Gilead is set in 1956 in the town of Gilead, Iowa. The story is told in the form of letters written by a 76-year-old Congregationalist minister who believes he is near death, revealing the story of his life to his 7-year-old son. The story encompasses the lives of his father, a pacifist, and his grandfather, who fought with John Brown and the abolitionists and lost an eye in the Civil War. Marilyn Robinson lives in Iowa and teaches at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. She belongs to the Congregationalist Church and is a former deacon. Terry spoke with Marilyn Robinson last month. They started with a reading from the beginning of the novel, as the father explains to his son that he is dying.
I don't know how many times people have asked me what death is like, sometimes when they were only an hour or two from finding out for themselves. Even when I was a very young man, people as old as I am now would ask me, hold on to my hands and look into my eyes with their old milky eyes, as if they knew I knew when they were going to make me tell them. I used to say it was like going home. We have no home in this world, I used to say. And then I'd walk back up the road to this old place and make myself a pot of coffee and a fried egg sandwich and listen to the radio, when I got one, in the dark as often as not. Do you remember this house? I think you must, a little. I grew up in parsonages. I've lived in this one most of my life, and I've visited in a good many others, because my father's friends and most of our relatives also lived in parsonages. And when I thought about it in those days, which wasn't too often, I thought this was the worst of them all, the draftiest and the dreariest. Well, that was my state of mind at the time. It's a perfectly good old house, but I was all alone in it then, and that made it seem strange to me. I didn't feel very much at home in the world. That was a fact. Now I do.
That's Marilyn Robinson reading from her new novel, Gilead. Your novel, Gilead, is written in the form of a letter. It's this minister, John Ames, in his 70s, who believes he is dying, writing a letter to his 7-year-old son that he hopes his son will read much later in life. And, you know, a lot of people advise beginning writers, write as if you're writing a letter home or a letter to your best friend, and that will help capture your most direct and natural voice. Did writing this novel in the form of a letter from father to son help in any way?
Well, writing a novel is an odd thing. The situation occurred to me as something that simply I wanted to enter into. I have never myself particularly liked to read epistolary novels, and I guess that's basically what this one is. But the given of this of the novel for me from the beginning was that he would be in this situation where he's speaking very lovingly to an adult man whom he will never know, his grown son, and trying to, in effect, be a father to someone who's much too young to actually remember him as father at the time that he imagines he will die. So I could almost say that I surprised myself. This isn't a kind of form that I would ever have imagined that I would choose to write in. I felt that I could do it because I knew the voice of the writer. I felt very strongly that I knew who this character was. So that it wasn't a problem, but it also wasn't a resource for me either.
The novel is written, I mean, he's writing this letter to his son in 1956, and he's in his 70s. So it's really, in a way, he's using the language of another era, and he's also a fairly, I shouldn't use the word formal exactly, but, I mean, he's not a frivolous man.
by any means.
No, he's not. the language you use very much reflects that. Like, instead of calling somebody, you know, nervous or fidgety, you'll write, he was the most unreposeful human being I ever knew. Can you talk a little bit about the language that seemed to suit the voice of this minister in 1956?
Well, one of the things that was characteristic in that tradition is that they were very highly educated people. And one of the things that they did do was establish many of the colleges that are scattered through the Middle West, places like Oberlin and Grinnell and Knox College, Carleton College, and so on, very fine little institutions that they established in the first instance as good liberal arts colleges, which were also on the Underground Railroad and egalitarian racially and so on before the Civil War. There was a very strong intellectual tradition, and he has a sort of, he has that sort of refinement about him in the first place. In the second place, he is writing to his son, and he, as he says, you know, he wants to give a candid version of his better self or something to that effect. In other words, not to be too distant, but on the other hand, also to present himself in a way that the son can respect, you know.
There's a sermon that he writes in, I think it's 1918. The flu pandemic is sweeping around the world and killing many people. And the United States has entered World War I, and a lot of soldiers who are preparing to go to Europe to fight in that war are dying here of the flu. And he's trying to think about what to tell the parents who are coming to church. Can you talk a little bit about what he thinks about telling them and why he decides to never actually give that sermon?
Well, he thinks of telling them that it is God's way of saying, don't enter war. You know, that if you have the option of doing it, don't do it. He lets the parents believe that he means that they're being spared the trenches and the mustard gas of the First World War. But what he means more profoundly is that God is sparing them the act of killing, which from his point of view, of course, is a greater rescue.
But he actually never gives that sermon. He burns it.
Yes.
Why does he burn it?
Well, it's a continuous problem, I think, that ministers have, that they're often speaking to people who actually agree with them. He doesn't have, among the people that come to his church through this pandemic when many, many things simply closed down, there are people who he knows are as heartbroken about all this death and all the warfare and so on as he is. So he sees no point in assuming the posture of preaching against something that he knows that everyone in the room is in grief about already.
Your minister, your main character, says, "For me, writing has always felt like praying, even when I wasn't writing prayers, as I was often enough." Is writing like praying for you?
I suppose it is. I sometimes think it's more like praying than praying is. I mean, in the sense that it, you have concrete evidence of what you have done and what you have shied away from and so on. Very interesting.
I don't think I quite get it. Tell me more about how for you the process of writing compares to prayer.
Well, I think it's a very hard thing to say, perhaps because people have different ideas and experiences related to prayer. For me, it's a kind of meditation. And I think that writing certainly is meditative in the sense that you have to feel that it answers to some standard of truth, however oblique the relationship of fiction to truth might be in the usual understanding of it.
Marilyn Robinson speaking to Terry Gross last month. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with author Marilyn Robinson. Her new novel, Gilead, is written in the form of a letter from a 76-year-old Congregationalist minister to his 7-year-old son. The minister believes he is dying and wants to pass on the story of his life.
You know, you're writing from the point of view of a minister, and I think you get to a lot of interesting things that a minister must experience. Like you write, you're describing a scene in which he's passing a group of people who are joking around with each other, but as soon as they see the minister, they stop joking. And the minister writes, That's the strangest thing about this life, about being in the ministry. People change the subject when they see you coming. And then sometimes those very same people come into your study and tell you the most remarkable things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I get a fair amount of mail and email and so on from ministers and priests and so on. And they confirm this, that on the one hand they are rather isolated, and on the other hand they are on terms of remarkable intimacy, often with people who have not treated them, you know, as people with whom they were familiar or at ease until confession or until counseling or whatever, you know.
I guess they're treated really differently when someone's alone in the room with them than in a group.
Yes, I think that's very true. And also, when they're fulfilling the role that they have, mm-hmm, of helping people to make sense of grief or crisis or anger or whatever, then of course they have to be privy to remarkable things.
So why do a lot of ministers write to you?
I think one of the main reasons is because ministers and priests are very used to being described in most unflattering terms in literature. And they're, I think, quite pleased in general to find that I've made a character who is likable, positive, intelligent, not a hypocrite.
Something else about your character, John Ames, the minister, he lost his young wife and their baby in childbirth, and then he was alone for decades until in his 60s he meets and marries a younger woman with whom he is deeply in love, and she is deeply in love with him, and it's a beautiful marriage. They have a son, and this is the son who he's writing to, and the whole novel is the letter to his son. But anyways, during those decades when he was lonely, when he had no wife and had no child, he felt very much on the outside of life. Do you comprehend that feeling of being on the outside of life, being set apart?
Oh, I suppose I do. I frankly, I don't know what it feels like to be anyone else. So I don't know how I compare with other people in terms of my familiarity with that experience. I think that that a lot of people spend a lot of their time feeling as if life is something that sort of goes on around them because other people's lives always appear perhaps more comprehensible than their own. I mean, what you see people do seems understandable because you don't understand their doubt or their anxiety or their duplicity or whatever else might be a factor in their behavior.
Your character confesses that through the long years that he lived alone, he, quote, suffered at the spectacle of all marriages, all the households overflowing with children. And he thinks he's guilty of violating the 10th commandment, the commandment that says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, neither shalt thou desire his servant, nor his handmaiden, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is his. And he thinks that this 10th commandment is the commandment that there can be no law against. No one can punish you for coveting, I mean, for being jealous. And you can't hold yourself accountable to that, too. It's behavior that's impossible for you to enforce. Hard to change. It's hard to change those kinds of desires. I found that section really interesting. And he goes on to say that he, as a minister, has often found it difficult to rejoice with those who rejoice, as the Bible says. And he's often been much better at weeping with those who weep.
Yes.
I think that's true of so many people, that this is like the whole Schadenfreude thing, that it's sometimes hard to feel other people's joy, and it's sometimes easier to weep with those who weep. But I thought you captured it in a really beautiful way. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think that the fact of his feeling jealousy in ways that he really can't control or can't rationalize himself out of, so that really the only recourse that he has is more or less to isolate himself when he can from these spectacles of happiness that he feels excluded from. I think that that's important to him in a way, in a positive way, because he is a Calvinist. That is his tradition. And one of the things that that tradition teaches is that everyone is wrong, everyone is flawed, and that the idea that anyone is in a position to judge someone else is a grave error. His character, of course, is of a kind to make him scrupulous about things like this. But at the same time, I think that his compassion can arise in a great part from the suffering that he feels as someone who cannot help but envy, cannot help but desire.
You've written about John Calvin and Calvinism. And in your novel, the minister says, Calvin says somewhere that each of us is an actor on a stage and God is the audience. That metaphor has always interested me because it makes us artists of our own behavior. And the reaction of God to us might be thought of as aesthetic rather than morally judgmental. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think, why did God create the world? How does he love the world? What in the world, if you imagine him, you know, through the lens of Christ, what in the world breaks his heart? It seems to me as if it's the sort of irreducible beauty and pathos of human beings and their capacity for love and their capacity for loyalty and all the rest that is simply beautiful, even though in many forms it is in error, it is possibly destructive, and so on. I think that, again, Calvin would say, if we were actually, you know, or as Hamlet said, you know, who would escape whipping, you know, if we were judged on moral terms, we wouldn't perhaps be worth attracting the notice of God in the way that theology assumes that we do, that it's the beauty of us and not the goodness of us, finally.
So is this almost like a discipline for you to try to focus on that beauty instead of judging people and to find beauty even in tragedy or ugliness?
Yes, I think that's probably fair to say.
Are you good at that? Do you succeed very often?
It's not the easiest thing in the world, you know, but that makes it interesting.
I imagine you've read the Bible. Pretty carefully as somebody who's interested in religion and the history of religion and as someone who's a writer and just as interested in language. The fundamentalists believe that the Bible is a literal truth and that it's, you know, inerring in its accuracy. As a writer who works so much with metaphor and with implied meaning, I just wonder what your reaction is to a fundamentalist reading of the Bible.
Well, I often wonder. I listen to the, you know, the self-declared religious people in the culture, and it seems to me as if they're obsessed with certain passages, 2, 3, 4, to the exclusion of the rest of the literature, you know. I'm struck by how seldom the Sermon on the Mount seems to be alluded to, for example. I think that if you are a scholar of the tradition, you become very aware that the great interpreters are also aware of the great complexity of interpretation. People like Calvin and Luther, both of whom made translations of the Bible, Calvin into Latin, but Luther into German, of course. If you read the commentaries, they know that a word can mean several things and that in many instances there's no way in the text to make a definitive translation and that it has to be understood as something that finally the reader determines and so on. The sola scriptura standard that is so often invoked as if it meant some sort of, you know, free form, free association, actually comes from the fact that it's a complex ancient literature that people with the best knowledge in the world struggle to translate. And therefore, one, the individual reader is highly responsible for the interpretation of many things that are crucial to it.
Well, Marilyn Robinson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Marilyn Robinson, speaking to Terry Gross last month. Robinson just won the National Critics Circle Award for her novel Gilead, and she's a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Coming up, a review of Old Boy, a new film from South Korea. This is Fresh Air. The winner of the Grand Jury Prize at the 2004 Cannes Film Festival was a revenge thriller from South Korea called Old Boy. It's been described as the Quentin Tarantino movie that Tarantino would be afraid to make. Old Boy opens in New York and L.A. this week and wider next month. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Vengeance dominates our modern action cinema, in which injured men and women not only have license to kill, but to smile while doing so. My response to movie revenge sagas is double-edged. I like them good and brutal, but feel a little soiled by the bloodlust they engender. To be a work of art, a vengeance movie needs to give you something more than your jollies. It needs to show the cost of revenge to society, which can't survive if injustice goes unpunished, but also can't survive if individuals take justice into their own unstable hands. I have my great vengeance director now in Park Chan-wook, a 41-year-old South Korean filmmaker whose movie Old Boy won the Grand Jury Prize at last year's Cannes Film Festival. Park understands the Western obsession with an eye for an eye, or an eye and a nose and some teeth for an eye, but he also imbues his Punch and Judy bloodbaths with a morbid Eastern detachment. Park's last film, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, is one of the most twisted and disturbing I've seen. It builds to a scenario in which parallel revengers wreak havoc on each other's lives. Neither is in the wrong exactly, but there's no jolt of triumph, just a bloody mess and a tragic sense of waste. And now there's Old Boy, with a simpler narrative architecture, but even twistier morals. Park opens with a rousing prologue in which a mop-headed man with dark eyes dangles another man off a roof by his tie. Before we have the faintest idea what's going on, we meet Oh Dae-soo, an ordinary Seoul businessman, in the throes of an epic bender on his young daughter's birthday. The jump cuts as he raves in the police station capture his fractured perception and portend the horror to come. Released, Oh Dae-soo staggers into the rainy night, phones his daughter, and then disappears, ending up in another prison, a private one, where his food is shoved through a hole in a door and sleeping gas pours in through vents. In his locked room, Oh Dae-soo learns from a TV set that his wife has been murdered and that his blood and hair were found at the scene. He's been framed, but by who? He slices into his arm to mark each passing year, and there are 15 slices before he wakes to find himself on that roof holding that man by the tie. Choi Min-sik is a riveting actor with deep, black, plaintive eyes. His Oh Dae-soo is part revenger, part robot. As he sets out to find out who locked him up, and more important, why, it's clear that his tormentor is beside him every step of the way, controlling him, addicted to watching him suffer. Is Oh Dae-soo the revenger? Or is the revenger his one-time captor? To reveal more would rob you of the disorientation that Old Boy instills, disorientation and vertigo and nausea, like a switchback ride into a swamp of bones. The central relationship between Odesu and a lovely young woman named Mido is tender and nuanced, but the violence everywhere else is sadistic and extreme. Even the meals approach the theater of cruelty. After Odesu demands something living at a sushi bar, he proceeds to consume a live octopus before our eyes, then retches and passes out. Obviously, this sort of taboo-flouting imagery isn't for everyone, but Park's vision is all of a piece. He came of age in a period of South Korean upheaval, and in his work, there's a pervasive distrust of authority combined with a pervasive lack of faith in individuals, most of whom are warped by their out-of-whack society. Old Boy is a movie where you think you're in hell from the first frame, but have no inkling of the infernal circles to come. You're left thinking the only thing worse than not avenging injustice is avenging injustice.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from TIAA Cref, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org, from Capella University, offering degrees online in education, business, technology, psychology, and human services at 1-888-CAPELLA, and from Jeep, introducing the trail-rated Jeep Liberty CRD with next-generation diesel technology, emissions and performance capabilities at jeep.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer Marianne Faithfull talks about her life, her music, and her newest CD, Before the Poison, which includes songs written by PJ Harvey. Join us for the next Fresh Air.